Take a trip into my garden. I've got so much to show ya. The fountains and the waters are begging just to know ya. And it's true, baby, I've been saving this for you, baby. I guess it's something like a funfair. Put gas into the motor, and boy, I'll meet you right there. We'll ride the roller coaster, cause it's true, baby, I've been saving this for you, baby. I need you to tell me right before it goes down. Promise me you'll hold my hand if I get scared now. Might tell you to take a second, baby, slow down. You should know I, you should know I. Yeah, I bloom, I bloom just for you. I bloom just for you. Dancing with the trees, and I've waited my whole life. It's true, baby, I've been saving this for you, baby. I need you to tell me right before it goes down. Promise me you'll hold my hand if I get scared now. Might tell you to take a second, baby, slow down. You should know I, you should know I. Yeah, I bloom.
Welcome to Garden Party on X-Ray FM. We're back from a June hiatus while X-Ray said goodbye to the Falcon Arts community and hello to our new studios in Southeast Portland. That was Troy Sivan with Bloom to open up the show, and I'm Megan McMillan, an Oregon State University Extension Master Gardener volunteer, and I'll be your host for the next hour. And no matter where you're joining us from here in the Beaver State today, friendly reminder, OSU Extension has got your back. Do you need advice on canning your harvest? We've got that. Do you want to bring 4-H to your community? That's also OSU Extension. Pretty much, you know, you name it. Forestry, community health programming and support, that's all OSU Extension. It's rad, it's public, it's here for you. You can learn more at extension.oregonstate.edu. And now, normally as a master gardener, there's nothing I love more than answering your questions about plants. But that new studio I mentioned at the top of the hour is not quite up and running yet. So today's show has been pre-recorded. So if you've got questions, you can reach me at radiogardenparty@gmail.com, or you can get in touch with an OSU Extension Master Gardener at metromastergardeners.org. Now, You can't wait. You want to bring Garden Party live from the studio back ASAP? Now, you know, I'm sure you can imagine setting up shop is not cheap, my gardening friends. So consider taking some of those dollars you saved from growing your own produce this summer and hitting up that big blue donate button at xray.fm. Now, if you throw down $50, you get invited to our opening party. $250, and your name is on the wall of fame forever. Or, you know, until humans can no longer survive climate change and the fungi outlive us all. And speaking of fungi, stay tuned for later in the show when Shelby Lynn from Wildwood Folk School returns to the program and we get real nerdy about the fungus kingdom. Fungi are super queer, and while I know we celebrate Pride every day here in Portland, it is our official party this month, so happy Pride Month, y'all. Will be a theme in today's show, and you know what? If love between two consenting adults, or as you will hear later in this program, plants, isn't a reason to party, I don't know what is. Let's keep that love theme going through this July episode. After this quick break, we are going to get plant reproduction Lesson 101. This is Garden Party on X-Ray FM, where radio is yours.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex for now. To the people at home in the crowd, it keeps coming anyhow. Don't decoy your voice, don't make me avoid the topic, cause that ain't gonna stop it.
Now we talk about sex on the radio and video shows. Many will know that anything goes. Pick up, needle, press pause, turn radio on. Will that stop us? I doubt it. Alright then, come on and spin.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about make any man's eyes pop. Fellas drool like fools, but then again, they're only human. The chick was a hit cause her body was a booming.
No love, just sex. Follow Max with a check and a note that last night. That last night was dope. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex.
Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex.
Wow. Welcome back to Garden Party on X-Ray FM. That was a cover of Salt and Pepper's Let's Talk About Sex by German band The Baseballs. And today we get to talk about plant sex, at least, you know, the basics. So next time you stop and smell the roses here in the City of Roses, think about this. The flower of a plant is its reproductive organ. That's the flower's sole purpose. We love them. They're pretty. They smell good. They support pollinators, but at the end of the day, the plant puts out a flower for one purpose and one purpose alone, and that's sexual reproduction. So what are you looking at there? The male part of a flower is called a stamen. So typically you'll see this as like a long strand, it's called a filament, like a long fiber, and it's got the pollen at the end. And a flower is likely to have more than one stamen, and that globby bit of pollen at the end is called the anther. And the pollen is held in the anther at the end of that strand, at the end of the filament, so it can be easily dispersed into the wind or rubbed off onto the body of a fuzzy visiting pollinator. Now, the female part of a flower is called the pistil, and that's generally in the center of the flower, and it consists of three parts. The stigma is located at the top, and so that's like, think of that as the receiving zone of the female part. The stigma is then connected by a nice direct route to the ovary called the style. And just like in humans, the ovary basically contains eggs, and those eggs are nested into ovules. And if the stigma receives male pollen and the eggs are fertilized, the ovules develop into seed. So sometimes we eat these seeds as is, sometimes these seeds are within fruits or other vegetative structures that we also eat. Sometimes these seeds turn into pods and they blow away in the wind, or they drop to the ground, or, you know, they get eaten by a bird and dropped somewhere else. And thus the circle of life continues. And that's the main mission of the plant, to reproduce. And this is why I'm always bugging you about deadheading your plants or harvesting your veggies and fruit as soon as they're ready for harvest. Because when you don't, your plant gets the signal that its work here is done. Reproduction is complete. Time to shut it down. Now you'll notice I didn't talk about petals, which are very pretty and they help us identify plants. Nor did I mention sepals, which are located at the base of the flower. And they have an important job. They protect the bud. You know, both are important, but they are not the main characters of the flower. That's the pistil and the stamen. But there's more. A flower is not just a flower. So there's a complete flower, which contains all those things I just mentioned. The stamen, the pistil, the petals, the sepal. A complete flower isn't male or female. It's both. And that rose you stopped to smell at the beginning, that's an example of a complete flower. You're smelling those male parts and the female parts. Well, I guess. But, you know, it's got both of those things all in one go. There's also a perfect flower, and that's a different thing. And that is a botanical term. A perfect flower, all it's got to have to be perfect is a functional stamen and pistil. Again, that's the male and female parts on one flower. It doesn't need the pretty parts, the petal and the sepal, to be perfect, just the stamen and the pistil. Now, not all flowers are perfect. Imperfect flowers can be either pistillate, that's the female flower, or staminate, and that's the male flower. They have only one part, only the pistil or the stamen. So why do you need to know this as an average home gardener? Because if you are dealing with an imperfect flower and you want that plant to reproduce, bear fruit, you need to know one more thing about it. So you need to know, is that plant monoecious, which means it has female and male flowers on the same plant? Because then you're good to go. That plant's going to get down with itself. So watermelon, hazelnuts, cucumbers, and squash, those are all monoecious plants. And so now you're wondering, wait, but then why are my cucumbers, why are my zucchini not bearing fruit yet? It's July. What's going on? Well, it's because with a lot of the cucurbits, the male flower emerges first. You don't get both the pistillate and the staminate flowers until later in the season. That male flower, the staminate flower, is going to come out first. And you can tell the difference because the stem to the male flower is long and skinny, and the female flower has like a little bit of a round and curvy plumpness right at the bud. And so you can tell the difference. You can tell if you have both. You do need both. And you might want to play some catch up if you're still not seeing fruits on your cucurbits. You can just get in there with like a Q-tip or a paintbrush and transfer the pollen from one to the other and help that plant sex along. So now you know what to look for. Now, dioecious species, on the other hand, are either male or female. So hops, hollies, pistachios, those all fall into this category. Those are dioecious plants. They're either going to be male or female. Now, sometimes you want the plant to bear fruit, in which case you'll need to plant both a male and female plant. But sometimes, most famously with ginkgos, you don't want the plant to bear fruit. So you need to be mindful of whether you've got a female or male plant. And then sometimes, just like humans, it's more complicated. Kiwis, for example, sometimes have bisexual flowers and sometimes only have male flowers and sometimes have both on the same plant. So plants can be queer too. And what a wonderful thing it is. And you know what else is super queer? I mentioned it at the top of the program. Mushrooms. So stay tuned for after the break. We're going to get a long catch up with our friend Shelby Lynn from Wildwood Folk School, where we're going to talk about that and a little bit more. This is Gardening Party on X-Ray. I'm very excited today to welcome back to Garden Party Shelby from Wildwood Folk School. I think it was probably winter time the last time we chatted. Very, very different time than midsummer in the Pacific Northwest. We were talking about foraging at that time. And it's such a fun thing to think about the world outside of our gardens and how we can get to know it and interact with it and be a part of it. And so I'm very curious, how is foraging in the Pacific Northwest different in summer than it is in the winter? The last time we chatted, get us up to speed. What's going on in your world now?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me back on the show. I'm so excited to be here. And foraging in summer is excellent. There are no bad seasons for foraging. It's just kind of thinking about like what's going to be in season when. And you can think about this as like where the sugars made from photosynthesis are being stored in plants is a really helpful way to think about it. So in the winter, all of their sugars are in their roots, and that's why it's a good season for harvesting roots. In the spring, they start to come up in shoots and leaves, and that's why it's the right time to harvest shoots and leaves. And so in the summer, we see a lot of like mature leaves, some of the last flowers, but a lot of like fruits and nuts are starting to come in the season, which is pretty exciting. So things like service berries, Western coltsfoot is one of my favorites. All of the raspberry blackberry family, so thimbleberries and salmon berries. Just a lot of beautiful things right now. Also, some really good mushrooms this time of year.
I was really curious about that, if there are mushrooms that are good to forage for in the summer, if that was just a wet season thing. So what's out there now?
Yeah, you're totally right that they like to come out more in the wet season. Because since mushrooms don't photosynthesize, they don't really care about the light so much. They care about soil temperature or the temperature of the tree that they're growing in. And then they care about moisture. So there are some that are thermophilic that like love the heat and that are popping out now that you can't even find in the winter. So things like chicken of the woods, summer oysters, or like a dead man's foot is a really fun one.
Yikes. I don't know that I want to eat that, but I'm sure it's great.
Yeah, it's not a good one to eat. It's a beautiful dye mushroom, but
Fair. Yeah, I was really curious. I am growing fruit and veg at home, and summer is peak time, needing so much sunlight for so many of the more like conventional vegetables that we grow as home growers. And I was curious, gosh, is there a peak season in the natural world? But it seems like there's always something to forage for. And I think that's really special. You brought up thimbleberry. That's one of my absolute favorite. Can you describe it to listeners? It's really special.
A woman after my own heart. Thimbleberry is so good. Thimbleberries have, they're in the raspberry genus. So they have these big, wide, kind of raspberry looking leaves, but they're really soft to the touch. And they grow on tall canes and they have beautiful little white flowers with like a raspberry or blackberry flower. But the fruit is out of this world. It's like if you'd made raspberry lemonade and then concentrated it down. Ugh,
Yes.
the perfect berry.
It's so cute. It's so delicate. It is called a thimbleberry because it looks like a little thimble. So it's sort of raspberry red, but a little bit different shape. And I will say you'll never find this, listeners, at the farmer's market. You'll never find this at the grocery store because it's so fragile. You have to take it off and pretty much immediately put it in your mouth, which is all you're going to want to do anyway. But unless you're driving while you're listening to this, stop what you're doing. Do a little Google image search of a thimbleberry and then start looking for them when you are out and about. And if you have the space to grow them at home, I really encourage you to go to whoever sells native plants near you and add thimbleberry to your own yard, and you're going to have this wonderful harvest. It will just be like sort of big and lush in those soft leaves that Shelby described, but have a lot of wonderful berries and fruits and flowers and all of those things that will sort of take your yard through the season as well. And like I said, I mean, you'll never be able to buy this fruit. It won't make it to market. It will only make it from your yard to your mouth, maybe your kitchen counter, maybe. But definitely go out there and consider adding this. But look for it when you are on your next hike. It's just a really, really delightful little treat. There are, you know, I think probably a lot of other berries that maybe are native to the Pacific Northwest that you are teaching people to find when they're out foraging, but that are great for the home garden as well. Tell us about the service berry.
Oh yeah, the service berry is not a true berry, but in the way that like a raspberry is also not a berry, so nobody cares about the difference. But it is a beautiful native fruit that grows on a small shrubbing tree, really great for the garden. They have beautiful aromatic white flowers, really lovely spring growth, and they have these small, I'm gesturing and you can't see this, listeners, but about the size of maybe your pinky joint, little fruit that turn beautiful purple in midsummer. It's also called Saskatoon and is the national berry of Canada. So if you've heard of Saskatoons, same thing.
Same thing. All right, same, same. Good.
And the flavor of the fruit itself is kind of like a blueberry, but the seeds have the taste of like a sweet almond. So altogether, it's just complex and interesting and lovely. And native pollinators adore it, and birds love it. It's not messy for your yard. It's really a lot of upsides. But I guess one thing to know if you're growing it at home is they are prone to getting some rust, especially when they're young. So just like little spots of orange, it doesn't usually hurt the tree. But not everybody likes that. So something to be aware of.
I think you have to be comfortable with sharing the bounty with the birds in your yard. You have to be comfortable with a little bit of imperfection to sort of get anything good. There's one native plant that I feel is just so such a wonderful space filler, such a wonderful way to feed pollinators, and can also feed us, that is typically forgotten about, and that's salal. Do you tell do you ever eat any salal? Do you ever harvest?
Oh, that's a wonderful one. Oh, it's another one that just to go back to something you were saying earlier, Megan, it is extra special because you don't find it in markets. It's extra special because either it's something that you're foraging or something that you're growing. And so you get to like kind of create this special connection with that plant and feel just a little bit closer to it by eating it in that way.
And you know what's really fun about some of these shrubs that we have mentioned is that one, they're very easy to grow here because they're meant to grow here. They're at home. But I will say I have a very large patch of salal in my yard, and it's mostly shade, dappled shade. And when I think and when I contrast that with my more like traditional vegetables, they need 10 hours of full sun to really reach maturity, if not more. They'll take all that they can get, with the exception of maybe like some lettuces and greens at this time of year when it's hot. And so it's really wonderful to be able to grow things that you can eat in shade when you open yourself up to some of these native shrubs that you can either forage for or grow at home, or a little bit of both. Get the best of both worlds. So it's really, really, really fun. I did. But I will say I have to do almost no maintenance to my salal and my native shrubs in general, and that's one of the things that I like about them. But this year I did go in and I just, made an effort to cut back some of the dead wood, just a little bit of rejuvenation, and man, did it respond. It is just new, sort of that light green growth everywhere. So many berries, and they're like, again, I'm gesturing, but bigger than a pinhead this time. They're really pretty lush berries, and it's fruit. Again, you're probably like, it's not actually a berry. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. It's delicious. So it's definitely worth exploring some of those options. I'm gonna take a quick break, and then we're gonna come back and we're gonna get more underground. right. Welcome back to Garden Party. I have Shelby from Wildwood Folk School here with us. And we were just talking about some awesome native shrubs that you can forage for. You can grow in your own yard. You can do a little bit of both. But now we're going to turn our energy elsewhere. And we are going to go a little bit underground for the most part. Let's talk about fungi. So I'm going to have a terrible pun here. So everyone who's listening groans, but I'm like, let's break them down. If you got that joke, you might already know what is coming. But I want to talk about fungi a little bit and maybe do some myth busting. You know, as I was reading up and preparing for this conversation, I kept coming across this phrase over and over and over again. All mushrooms are fungi, but not all fungi are mushrooms. And I think that's really important for our listeners to know and remember. So can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, absolutely. I love fungi so much. So fungi are a kingdom of life in the same way that animals are or plants are. Mm-hmm. And so it includes different types of fungi, like molds, yeasts, and also mushrooms. And what kind of defines them is that they're spore-producing organisms that lack chlorophyll. They are not able to make their own food. They're mm-hmm. They're heterotrophs like you and I. So we have to get our food by eating other people mm-hmm. versus plants who are autotrophs, make their own food from the sun.
Yeah.
It's kind of similar to thinking about how all mammals are animals, but not all animals are mammals.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so important to know. I know we love our fermented beverages from beer and whatnot in this town. You are interacting with fungi when you go out and get that beer. And so you mentioned they do not photosynthesize. And we talked in the first segment about how that can be really wonderful because that means that they are existing at all times of the year and not necessarily as susceptible to the seasons as maybe plants are. But how do they get nutrients?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. First, let me just quickly define what a mushroom is. So a mushroom is the reproductive body possessed by some fungi. Mm-hmm. So it's not an organism in and of itself. It's just the reproductive organs. Okay. Yeah. So you can imagine it as like the fruit of a tree, like the berry from a bush.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons that like we can often harvest more fungi than we would whole plants, because it is easy for the organism to create new reproductive structures. It does not kill the organism to take the mushroom. There's exceptions to that, but in general. And so because they don't photosynthesize, they have like a few different ways that they can eat. Some are saprobic, so they're detrivores. Those are ones that are breaking down plant material and eating it.
Okay.
So oyster mushrooms are a great example, really common example. You find them growing on trees and they are breaking down and eating the cellulose and lignin from those trees. Other mushrooms are mycorrhizal, and people are so excited about mycorrhizal mushrooms right now. I love it.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that create mutualistic symbiotic relationships with plants. And we've discovered almost every plant on the planet has symbiotic relationships with these mycorrhizal fungi. So they help plants grow bigger and better, and the plants help the mushrooms grow bigger and better as well. So a great example of that is the Amanita muscaria, the Mario mushroom, the red one with the white spot.
Yeah.
It makes little friendships with coniferous trees. And so I like to think of it as the tip of the plant's root and the tip of the mushroom's hypha, which is kind of sort of a little bit looks like a root, are holding hands. And then they trade nutrients back and forth.
That's incredible. Really
Yeah.
And it's important for us gardeners
to know. Hopefully you're already familiar with this, but now you know how important these things are. And you might even notice in a really, really healthy soil, sort of like it looks like white, stretchy stuff. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. You want that. That's good. That's the good stuff.
We want lots of it. For a home gardener, there are so many opportunities to grow plants and mushrooms in tandem together where they can just really make each other better. I also want to add that there's some weird ones that eat in different ways, some that are endophytic. Those are ones that live in the interstitial space between the cells of plants. Super strange.
How did we even find them? Oh, this is so cool. I love it.
Yeah. I imagine some guy was just like, looking at plants under a microscope and was like, what's this thing? And then there are pathogenic ones. So parasitic mushrooms that eat off of animals. So like we have ringworm is an example that, you know, many of us may have had running around barefoot as children. That's a mushroom that eats your skin cells.
Okay. And then, so mushrooms that, you know, there's sort of this reproductive body, this fruiting body. Tell us more about fungi, reproduction. We learned how they eat. How do they get down?
Yeah, their reproduction is really complicated. So it's spore-based. So they are older than plants. Seeds are a relatively recent development. You know, in the like very long scale of time. And some of our oldest plants will also have spores. Like horsetails are a good example of a spore bearing plant. But these guys use spores, to reproduce, and they also will have sexual reproduction that sometimes requires multiple types of sexes beyond what you'll see in the animal kingdom. So, for example, the split gill mushroom has more than 30,000 different types of sexes. And from in there, you have to find a compatible sexual partner in order to be able to reproduce. It's pretty incredible. And if you are trying to learn more about fungi, if you're trying to identify fungi, one of the best ways to be able to recognize different mushrooms is to look at their spore-bearing parts.
Okay, so what would those be?
Yeah, traditional cap and stalk mushroom that has like, you know, the cap.
Like, close your eyes and think of a mushroom. It's that.
That. So if you look at the underside of that cap that looks like a little hat on top of the of the mushroom, the bottom side of that is full of basidia, which are spore-producing bodies, and they're laid out in different ways. So if it has long tubes, it's what we would call a polypore. If it has gills, we'd call it a gilled mushroom. There's also toothed mushrooms, which are a little less common, but like the bear's head is a really famous one around here. Oh, and I have, this is not related, but because you were asking about photosynthesis, and it's just a kind of a fun thing. So we don't have any photosynthetic fungi, but there are radiotrophic fungi, fungi that eat radioactive energy that does not come from the sun. So there's, for example, there's a species that grows inside the nuclear reactor at Chernobyl and is living its best life there. It is actively eating the radiation coming out of Chernobyl, and that's a cladosporium species. But there are a few different ones that live in places of high radiation. And instead of eating the sun's radiation, they're just eating domestic terrestrial radiation, which is wild.
That is wild. And then what do they do with that? Do they excrete waste like an animal would, for example? Or does it just make it magically go away?
They release certain types of metabolites as waste, but it wouldn't be anything that's like visible to the human eye. So to us, it looks like, you know, like they're absorbing radiation and it magically disappears. which is pretty neat. And they can sometimes, some fungi and even some mushrooms can form symbiotic relationships with alga or algae and or cyanobacteria and create lichens.
And what makes lichens different?
A lichen is an emergent property. So it doesn't exist when either of these several organisms are separated. They are just themselves. So a mushroom by itself, just a mushroom. Alga just by itself, just an alga. But when they come together, they create this whole new thing. The shape changes, the way they eat changes, everything is different. And because algae are able to photosynthesize, they are able to make sugars from the sun and share it with the mushroom. And in exchange, the mushroom like builds a little house for the algae and keeps them protected from things that would like to eat the algae.
Yeah, you know, as I'm listening to you, I feel like there's this stack ranking of most sustainable food for humans to least sustainable. And it feels like, of course, at the bottom is animal. That's the least sustainable food for us. We need to be the most mindful about that. And then maybe plant. And then are fungi the most sustainable food for us? Because if I'm harvesting a mushroom, that doesn't kill the main fungi, right? It leaves it behind. It can continue to reproduce. That's pretty cool.
It's so cool. Yeah, that's totally correct. For most species of fungi, for most species of mushrooms, their reproductive bodies only live for a short period of time. And their only job is to set out spores and die. And so especially if we like give them time to release their spores and then eat them, it's incredibly sustainable. There are some exceptions to this. There are some types of tough woody shelf mushrooms that can live decades. And so those ones we want to be much more careful with. But the vast majority of mushrooms are extremely, extremely sustainable and like so ecologically valuable and just also very pretty.
So I was reading about this, these fungi, these mushrooms that can live forever and ever. And it sounds like, tell me if this is true or not. It said the largest and oldest living creature on Earth is a mushroom found in the Blue Mountains of right here in Oregon. Is that true?
It's so true. It's incredible. Yeah. And it's, you know, I think even native Oregonians sometimes don't realize that we have, you know, the largest and oldest organism essentially in our backyards. And you can just go visit there. It's the honey fungus. So the actual mushrooms themselves only live for a short period, for a few weeks. But the organism underground, the mycelium, like you were describing, when you pull up the soil, there's like those long white filaments.
Yeah.
That thing has been alive for thousands of years and is out in Malheur. And you can go visit it in the fall when the mushrooms pop up, and you can see and feel the oldest organism, as far as we know, in the world.
Yeah. And just to give everyone an idea of this size, it covers what we know, at least, and there's probably a lot that we don't know here, 2,384 acres. So that's 1,665 football fields. That's a lot. That's a lot. That's a very American way of looking at it, but here we are. And then, you know, we don't know how old it is, but it's at least, we think, 2,400 years old. It could be over 8,000 years old. So cool. So cool.
Amazing.
I want to go see it. I want to go, you know, just sort of hang out and see what I can learn. But that is very, very cool. And there's really so many other cool things about mushrooms. And, you know, I think everyone always wants to know, like, well, are they closer to an animal or a plant? And it's like, they're neither. Get comfortable with it. Get comfortable with the non-binary, folks. You know, I was reading about it and just trying to understand, like, the anatomy a little bit. And some of the cool things that we have learned. And so gardeners, we know what cellulose is, right? Like that's kind of like the skeleton of our plants. So what makes up the cell walls, it makes them stand up. Super, super important. That's why we've got to feed it so that stays strong. So fungi doesn't have cellulose. It has, am I pronouncing this right? Is it chitin? Chitin?
Chitin.
Chitin, chitin. Okay. So tell us about this. And it is found in other kingdoms, but it might surprise Garden Party listeners. So tell us about chitin.
Yeah, absolutely. So just like you were saying, it's analogous to the skeleton of a plant of cellulose. But fungi, their skeletons, quote unquote skeletons, are made up of chitin, which is a polysaccharide. So it's actually a complex sugar. And it's a polymer, so it's made up of like teeny tiny simple sugars all stitched together in a chain. But it's not sweet like a simple sugar would be, to be so clear. If you expect that, you will be disappointed. But it makes a really tough material that you can also find, like you were saying, in the animal kingdom. It's actually the second most common polymer in the world. And where you find it is in crustaceans, in crabs. So it is the thing that makes crab shells hard is chitin. And also insects, hard-shelled insects, their exoskeletons are made of chitin.
So cool.
So cool, so weird. And so even though we often think about fungi as being more similar to plants, the study of mycology, the study of mushrooms only really started in the 1960s. Until then, people thought they just were plants. That's one of the ways in which they are more like us, more like animals, than they are like plants. It's so neat. It's very weird.
Well, tell us more about the anatomy. Anything, any other fun facts?
Yeah, well, this is a whole thing, but there's like two kind of broad categories of mushrooms, the fruiting bodies. There's ascomycetes and basidiomycetes. And so the basidiomycetes are the kind of traditional mushroom shape, right? It's got a stalk and a cap and then a bottom, which is maybe gills or pores or teeth or whatever. And then there's ascomycetes who have no rules. They are just madness and chaos. It's just anarchy in the ascomycetes. And so they can have shapes like cups. If you've ever seen like a cup fungus, gardeners will probably recognize bird's nest cup fungus often appears in gardens, or morels, which are shaped like a brain. And we can get really strange ones, like gelatinous blobs are a pretty common shape in that kingdom. So, witch's butter, if people have seen witch's butter jelly fungus, and really like the if you look at basidiomycetes, there's clear kind of ways that they are, clear kind of rules. But once you start looking at ascomycetes, everything you think you know about mushrooms just goes out the window, and they can be, their bodies can be as diversely shaped as animal bodies, like as different as a sea anemone, versus a mountain lion. And it's pretty cool and exciting.
So, if Garden Party listeners are inspired to get in on this fun, whether it's foraging, whether it's growing mushrooms at home, a little bit in between, I guess first things first for the home garden, any advice that you have for anyone who wants to start growing mushrooms at home?
Absolutely. Do it. My advice is do it. It can feel intimidating sometimes, but once you set up some good fungi in your garden, there are some species you can kind of set and forget, and they will just keep adding so much to your garden throughout the year. There are also some companies that create like kits that are a lot easier to get started with. So you don't have to like breed mycelia or learn about inoculation, which is a whole thing. You can just get pre-inoculated kits and just kind of chuck them in your garden. Some ones I would really recommend are the quote unquote garden king Strafaria. That's a really easy to grow mushroom. It's very beautiful, very easy to cook. They're about, the caps are about the size of my head and a beautiful kind of oxblood color, and extremely delicious. Oysters are also super easy to grow. And I would recommend doing deep mulching and growing your oyster mushrooms in the deep mulch. They will break down that mulch to make it more accessible for your plants. And whenever you water them and it's the right temperature, you'll get big flushes of oyster mushrooms. And you keep feeding them and you'll have them for years to come.
So cool. And then, you know, if you want to learn with others, if you want to learn from the best and you want to get out and about with Wildwood Folk School, what do y'all have coming up?
Yeah, we have a few things coming up. So we, as your listeners may or may not know, we're a nonprofit. So we have a number of free programs. We have a free plant walk every month. This is airing in July. So I believe our next one is going to be August 16th. And then we also do other types of foraging and like foraged craft related classes. So we have a cattail hat making class where you weave cattail leaves into hats on the 29th and 30th of August. I also do some freelance things, some freelance teaching, and you can find me teaching about lichen dyes and lichenology at Wildcraft Studio on November 14th. I also just want to say for folks, if you're interested in learning more about foraging in general, if you're interested in learning more about fungi, there are so many good resources out there. Please join your local mycological society. They tend to be really friendly, cheap, and also just full of nerds.
Yes,
so many good
get
nerds.
Nerdy about it. You will be Ooh. Among friends. I love it so Ooh. Much. Well, Shelby, it's always a joy to have you. Happy summer to you. And thanks so much for joining. And that's wildwoodfolkschool.com. Wildwoodfolkschool.com. If you want to hear what they're up to, Shelby, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you, Megan. Always a treat.
A garden party to reminisce with my old friends, a chance to share old memories and play our songs again.
Welcome back to Garden Party on X-Ray FM. Many thanks to Shelby Lynn from Wildwood Folk School, who joined me for a conversation today. You also heard Barking at the Sun from No Joy and Forget Her from Girl in Red in between those interviews. A reminder, I'm not live today while X-Ray moves into our brand new studios, so you can reach me at radiogardenparty@gmail.com or get in touch with an OSU Extension Master Gardener at metromastergardeners.org with any questions. And of course, hit up that big blue donate button at X-Ray FM to lend a few bucks to our move-in fund. Many, many, many thanks. This is Garden Party on X-Ray FM, where radio is yours. You can find us on KXRY Portland at 91.1 and 107.1 here in Portland, and 91.7 FM in Nehalem, Manzanita, and Rockaway Beach. Of course, streaming online everywhere at xray.fm, including the archives of all your favorite garden parties and the playlists of the songs I've played. I'm Megan McMillan, an OSU Extension Master Gardener volunteer. And I'll catch you next month.
Played them all the old songs. Thought that's why they came. No one heard the music. We didn't look the same. I said hello to Mary Lou. Belongs to me. When I sang a song about a honky tonk, it was time to leave. But it's all right now. I learned my lesson well. You see, you can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself.